Silver stars weren't awarded frequently, and gold stars happened less than once a fortnight and were vied for accordingly. Right now, Miss Susan selected a silver star. Pretty soon, Vincent the Keen would have a galaxy of his very own. To give him his due, he was quite disinterested in which kind of star he got. Quantity. That was what he liked. Miss Susan had privately marked him down as boy most likely to be killed one day by his wife. She walked back to her desk and laid the star, tantalizingly, in front of her. And an extra special question, she said with a hint of malice. Does that mean it's then there, when it's now here? The hand slowed halfway in its rise. Ooh, Vincent began and then stopped. Oh, doesn't make sense, miss. Questions don't have to make sense, Vincent, said Miss Susan, but answers do. There was a kind of sigh from Penelope. To Miss Susan's surprise, the face that one day would surely cause her father to have to hire bodyguards was emerging from its normal happy daydream and wrapping itself around an answer. Her alabaster hand was rising, too. The class watched expectantly. Yes, Penelope? It's... Yes? It's always now, everywhere, miss? Exactly right. Well done. All right, Vincent, you can have the silver star. And for you, Penelope. Miss Susan went back to the cupboard of stars. Getting Penelope to step off her cloud long enough even to answer a question was worth a star, but a deep philosophical statement had to make it a gold one. I want you all to open your notebooks and write down what Penelope just told us, she said brightly as she sat down. And then she saw the inkwell on her desk beginning to rise like Penelope's hand. It was a ceramic pot, made to drop neatly into a round hole in the woodwork. It came up smoothly and turned out to be balanced on the cheerful skull of the death of rats. It winked one blue-glowing eye socket at Miss Susan. With quick little movements, not even looking down, she whisked the inkwell aside with one hand and reached for a thick volume of stories with the other. She brought it down so hard on the hole that blue-black ink splashed from the inkwell onto the cobbles. Then she raised the desk lid and peeped inside. There was, of course, nothing there, but at least nothing macabre. Unless you counted the piece of chocolate half-gnawed by rat teeth and a note in heavy Gothic lettering saying, "See me," and signed by a very familiar alpha and omega symbol and the word grandfather. Susan picked up the note and screwed it into a ball, aware that she was trembling with rage. How dare he! And to send the rat, too! She tossed the ball into the waste paper basket. She never missed. Sometimes the basket moved in order to ensure that this was the case. And now we'll go and see what time it is in clutch, she told the watching children. On the desk, the book had fallen open at a certain page, and later on, it would be story time. And Miss Susan would wonder, too late, why the book had been on her desk when she had never even seen it before. And a splash of blue-black ink would stay on the cobbles of the square in Genoa, until the evening rainstorm washed it away.
The first words read by seekers of enlightenment in the secret, gong-banging, yeti-haunted valleys near the hub of the world are read when they look into the life of Wen the Eternally Surprised. The first question they ask is, why was he eternally surprised? And they are told, Wen considered the nature of time and understood that the universe is, instant by instant, recreated anew. Therefore, he understood there is, in truth, no past, only a memory of the past. Blink your eyes, and the world you see next did not exist when you closed them. Therefore, he said, the only appropriate state of the mind is surprise. The only appropriate state of the heart is joy. The sky you see now, you have never seen before. The perfect moment is now. Be glad of it. The first words read by the young Lutzer when he sought perplexity in the dark, teeming, rain-soaked city of Ankh-Morpork were, rooms for rent, very reasonable. And he was glad of it.
Where there is suitable country for grain, people farm. They know the taste of good soil. They grow grain. Where there is good steel country, furnaces turn the sky to sunset red all night. The hammers never stop. They make steel. There is coal country, and beef country, and grass country. The world is full of countries where one thing shapes the land and the people. And up here in the high valleys around the hub of the world, where the snow is never far away, this is enlightenment country. Here are people that know that there is no steel, only the idea of steel.
But they still use forks, or at least the idea of forks. There may, as the philosopher says, be no spoon, although this begs the question of why there is the idea of soup.
They give names to new things and things that don't exist. They seek the essence of being and the nature of the soul. They make wisdom. Temples command every glacier-headed valley where there are particles of ice in the wind, even at the height of summer. There are the listening monks, seeking to discern within the hubbub of the world the faint echoes of the sounds that set the universe in motion. There are the Brothers of Cool, a reserved and secretive sect, which believes that only through ultimate coolness can the universe be comprehended, and that black works with everything, and that chrome will never truly go out of style. In their vertiginous temple crisscrossed with tightropes, the balancing monks test the tension of the world and then set out on long, perilous journeys to restore its equilibrium. Their work may be seen on high mountains and isolated islets. They are small brass weights, none of them bigger than a fist. They work. Well, obviously they work. The world has not tipped up yet. And in the highest, greenest, airiest valley of all, where apricots are grown and the streams have floating ice in them even on the hottest day, is the monastery of Oi Dong and the fighting monks' order of Wen. The other sects call them the history monks. Not much is known about what they do, although some have remarked on the strange fact that it is always a wonderful spring day in the little valley, and the cherry trees are always in bloom. The rumor is that the monks have some kind of duty to see that tomorrow happens according to some mystic plan devised by some man who kept on being surprised. In fact, for some time now, and it would be impossible and ridiculous to say how long, the truth has been stranger and more dangerous. The job of the history monks is to see that tomorrow happens at all. The Master of Novices met with Rinpo, chief acolyte to the abbot. At the moment, at least, the position of chief acolyte was a very important post. In his current condition, the abbot needed many things done for him, and his attention span was low. In circumstances like this, there is always someone willing to carry the load. There are Rinpos everywhere. "It's Ludd again," said the Master of Novices. "Oh, dear, surely one naughty child can't trouble you." "One ordinary naughty child, no. Where is this one from?" "Master Soto sent him, you know, of our Ankh-Morpork section. He found him in the city. The boy has a natural talent, I understand," said Rinpo. The Master of Novices looked shocked. "Talent? He's a wicked thief. He'd been apprenticed to the Guild of Thieves," he said. "Well, children sometimes steal. Beat them a little and they stop stealing. Basic education," said Rinpo. "Ah, there is a problem." "Yes?" "He is very, very fast. Around him, things go missing. Little things, unimportant things. But even when he is watched closely, he is never seen to take them."
"Then perhaps he does not?"
"He walks through a room and things vanish," said the Master of Novices. He's that fast? It's just as well Soto did find him then. But a thief is... They turn up later, in odd places, said the Master of Novices, apparently grudging the admission. He does it out of mischief, I'm sure. The breeze blew the scent of cherry blossom across the terrace. Look, I am used to disobedience, said the Master of Novices. That is part of a novice's life. But he is also tardy. Tardy? He turns up late for his lessons. How can a pupil be tardy here? Mr. Ludd doesn't seem to care. Mr. Ludd seems to think he can do as he pleases. He is also smart. The acolyte nodded. Ah, smart. The word had a very specific meaning here in the valley. A smart boy thought he knew more than his tutors, and answered back and interrupted. A smart boy was worse than a stupid one. He does not accept discipline? Said the acolyte. Yesterday, when I was taking the class for temporal theory in the stone room, I caught him just staring at the wall, clearly not paying attention. But when I called out to him to solve the problem I chalked on the blackboard, knowing full well that he could not, he did so. Instantly. And correctly. Well, you did say he was a smart boy. The Master of Novices looked embarrassed. Except it was not the right problem. I had been instructing the 5th gym field agents earlier and had left part of the test on the board. An extremely complex phase space problem involving residual harmonics in N histories? None of them got it right. To be honest, even I had to look up the answer. So, I take it you punished him for not answering the right question? Obviously, but that sort of behavior is disruptive. Most of the time I think he's not all there. He never pays attention, he always knows the answers, and he can never tell you how he knows. We can't keep thrashing him. He's a bad example to the other pupils. There's no educating a smart boy. The acolyte thoughtfully watched a flight of white doves circle the monastery roofs. We cannot send him away now, he said at last. Soto said he saw him perform the stance of the coyote. That's how he was found. Can you imagine that? He'd had no training at all. Can you imagine what would happen if someone with that kind of skill ran around loose? Thank goodness Soto was alert. But he has turned him into my problem. The boy disrupts tranquility. Rinpo sighed. The Master of Novices was a good and conscientious man, he knew, but it had been a long time since he'd been out in the world. People like Soto spent every day in the world of time. They learned flexibility, because if you were stiff out there, you were dead. People like Soto. Now there was an idea. He looked toward the other end of the terrace, where a couple of servants were sweeping up the fallen cherry blossom. I see a harmonious solution, he said. Oh, yes? An unusually talented boy like Ludd needs a master, not the discipline of the schoolroom. Possibly, but... The Master of Novices followed Rinpo's gaze. Oh, he said, and he smiled in a way that was not entirely nice. This smile contained a certain anticipatory element, a hint that trouble might be in store for someone who, in his opinion, richly deserved it. A name occurs, said Rinpo. To me also, said the Master of Novices. A name I've heard too often. Rinpo went on. I suppose that either he will break the boy, or the boy will break him, or it is always possible they will break each other, the master mused. So, in the patois of the world, said Rinpo, there is no actual downside. Would the abbot approve, though, said the master, testing a welcome idea for any weak points. He has always had a certain rather tiresome regard for... the sweeper. The abbot is a dear, kind man, but at the moment his teeth are giving him trouble, and he is not walking at all well, said Rinpo. And these are difficult times. I'm sure he will be pleased to accept our joint recommendation. Why, it's practically a minor matter of day-to-day affairs. And thus the future was decided. They were not bad men. They had worked hard on behalf of the valley for hundreds of years. But it is possible, after a while, to develop certain dangerous habits of thought. One is that, while all important enterprises need careful organization, it is the organization that needs organizing, rather than the enterprise. And another is that tranquility is always a good thing.
There was a row of alarm clocks on the table by Jeremy's bed. He did not need them because he woke up when he wanted to. They were there for testing. He set them for 7 and woke up at 6:59 to check that they went off on time. Tonight he went to bed early with a drink of water and the Grimm fairy tales. He had never been interested in stories at any age and had never quite understood the basic concept. He'd never read a work of fiction all the way through. He did remember as a small boy being really annoyed at the depiction of Hickory Dickory Dock in a rag book of nursery rhymes because the clock in the drawing was completely wrong for the period. He tried to read Grimm fairy tales. They had titles like How the Wicked Queen Danced in Red Hot Shoes and The Old Lady in the Oven. There was simply no mention of clocks of any sort in any of them. Their authors seemed to have a thing about not mentioning clocks. The glass clock of Bad Shoeshine, on the other hand, did have a clock, of a sort, and it was odd. A wicked man, readers could see he was wicked because it said he was wicked right there on the page, built a clock of glass in which he captured time herself. But things went wrong because there was one part of the clock, a spring, that he couldn't make out of glass, and it broke under the strain, and time was set free, and the man aged 10,000 years in a second and crumbled to dust and, not surprisingly in Jeremy's opinion, was never seen again. The story ended with a moral. Large enterprises depend upon small details. Jeremy couldn't see why it couldn't have just as well been, it's wrong to trap non-existent women in clocks, or it would have worked with a glass spring. But even to Jeremy's inexperienced eye, there was something wrong with the whole story. It read as though the writer was trying to make sense of something he'd seen or been told and had misunderstood things. And, ha! Although it was set hundreds of years ago when even in Uberveld there were only natural cuckoo clocks, the artist had drawn a long case clock of the sort that wasn't around even 15 years ago. The stupidity of some people, you'd laugh if it wasn't so tragic. He put the book aside and spent the rest of the evening doing a little design work for the guild. They paid him handsomely for this, provided he promised never to turn up in person. Then he put the work on the bedside table by the clocks. He blew out the candle. He went to sleep. He dreamed. The glass clock ticked. It stood in the middle of the workshop's wooden floor, giving off a silvery light. Jeremy walked around it, or perhaps it spun gently around him. It was taller than a man. Within the transparent case, red and blue lights twinkled like stars. The air smelled of acid. Now his point of view dived into the thing, the crystalline thing, plunging down through the layers of glass and quartz. They rose past him, their smoothness becoming walls hundreds of miles high, and still he fell between slabs that were becoming rough, grainy, full of holes. The blue and red lights were here too, pouring past him. And only now was there sound. It came from the darkness ahead, a slow beat that was ridiculously familiar, a heartbeat magnified a million times. Chum! Chum! Each beat slower than mountains and bigger than worlds, dark and blood red. He heard a few beats, and then his fall slowed, stopped, and he began to soar back up through the sleeting light until a brightness ahead became a room. He had to remember all this. It was all so clear once you saw it, so simple, so easy. He could see every part, how they interlocked, how they were made. And now it began to fade. Of course, it was only a dream. He told himself that and was comforted by it. But he had gone to some length with this one, he had to admit. For example, there was a mug of tea steaming on the nearby workbench, and the sound of voices on the other side of the door. There was a knocking at the door. Jeremy wondered if the dream would end when the door was opened, and then the door disappeared, and the knocking went on. It was coming from downstairs.
The time was 6:47. Jeremy glanced at the alarm clocks to make sure they were right, then pulled his dressing gown around him and hurried downstairs. He opened the front door a crack. There was no one there.
Nah, down here, mister.
Someone lower down was a dwarf.
9 o'clock, son,
he said.
Yes?
A clipboard was thrust through the gap.
Sign here where it says sign here. Thank you. Okay, lads.
Behind him, a couple of trolls tipped up a handcart. A large wooden crate crashed onto the cobbles.
What is this?
Said Jeremy.
Express package, said the dwarf, taking the clipboard. Come all the way from Uberveld. Must have cost someone a packet. Look at all them seals and stickers on it. Can't you bring it in?
Jeremy began, but the cart was already moving off with the merry jingle and tinkle of fragile items. It started to rain. Jeremy peered at the label on the crate. It was certainly addressed to him in a neat round hand, and just above it was the seal with the double-headed bat of Uberfeld. There were no other markings anywhere except, near the bottom, the words Pu Edis Sit. Then the crate started to swear. It was muffled and in a foreign language, but all swearing has a certain international content.
Hello,
said Jeremy. The crate rocked and landed on one of the long sides with extra cursing. There was some thumping from inside, some louder swearing, and the crate teetered upright again with the alleged top the right way up. A piece of board slid aside and a crowbar dropped out and onto the street with a clang. The voice that had lately been swearing said,
If you would be so good.
Jeremy inserted the bar into a likely-looking crack and pulled. The crate sprang apart. He dropped the bar. There was a creature inside.
I don't know,
it said, pulling bits of packing material off itself.
8 bloody days with no problems, and those idiots get it wrong on the doorstep.
It nodded at Jeremy.
Good morning, sir. I suppose you are Mr. Jeremy?
Yes, but
my name is Igor, sir. My credentials, sir.
A hand like an industrial accident, held together with stitches, thrust a sheaf of papers toward Jeremy. He recoiled instinctively, and then felt embarrassed and took them.
I think there has been a mistake, he said.
No mistake,
said Igor, pulling a carpet bag out of the ruins of the crate.
You need an assistant, and when it comes to assistance, you cannot go wrong with an Igor. Everyone knows that. Could we go in out of the rain, sir? It makes my knees rust.
But I don't need an assistant, Jeremy began. But that was wrong, wasn't it? He just couldn't keep assistants. They always left within a week.
Morning, sir,
said a cheery voice. Another cart had pulled up. This one was painted a gleaming, hygienic white and was full of milk churns and had R. Soak Dairyman painted on the side. Distracted, Jeremy looked up at the beaming face of Mr. Soak, who was holding a bottle of milk in each hand.
1 pint, squire, as per usual, and perhaps another one if you've got company.
Yes, thank you.
And the yogurt is particularly fine this week, squire,
said Mr. Soak encouragingly.
I think not, Mr. Soak.
Need any eggs, cream, butter, buttermilk, or cheese?
Not as such, Mr. Soak.
Right you are, then,
said Mr. Soak, unabashed.
See you tomorrow, then.
Yes,
said Jeremy as the cart moved on. Mr. Soak was a friend, which in Jeremy's limited social vocabulary meant someone I speak to once or twice a week. He approved of the milkman because he was regular and punctual and had the bottles at the doorstep every morning on the stroke of 7 a.m.
Goodbye,
he said. He turned to Igor.
How did you know I needed...
he tried, but the strange man had gone indoors, and a frantic Jeremy tracked him down in the workshop.
Oh, yes, very nice,
said Igor, who was taking it all in with the air of a connoisseur.
That's a Turnbull MK3 microwave, isn't it? I saw it in their catalogue.
Very nice indeed.
I didn't ask anyone for an assistant,
said Jeremy.
Who sent you?
We are Igor, sir.
Yes, you said. Look, I don't...
No, sir. We are Eagles, sir. The organization, sir.
What organization?
For placement, sir. You see, sir, the thing is, an Eagle often finds himself between masters, through no fault of his own, you see. And on the other hand...
You have two thumbs, breathed Jeremy, who had just noticed and couldn't stop himself. Two on each hand.
Oh, yes, sir, very handy,
said Igor, not even glancing down.
On the other hand, there is no shortage of people wanting an Eagle, so my Aunt Igorina runs our select little agency.
For lots of Eagles? Said Jeremy.
Oh, there's a fair number of us. We're a big family.
Igor handed Jeremy a card. He read, We are Igors. A spare hand when needed. The old rat house, bad shoeshine, female, yes, master, Uberfelt. Jeremy stared at the semaphore address. His normal ignorance of anything that wasn't to do with clocks did not apply here. He'd been quite interested in the new cross-continent semaphore system after hearing that it made quite a lot of use of clockwork mechanisms to speed up the message flow. So you could send a Klax message to hire an Igor? Well, that explained the speed, at least.
Rat house, he said. That means something like a council hall, doesn't it?
Normally, though. Normally,
said Igor reassuringly.
Do you really have semaphore addresses in Uberfelt?
Oh, yes. We are ready to grasp the future with both hands, sir.
And four thumbs.
Yes, sir. We can grasp like anything.
And then you mailed yourself here?
Certainly, sir. We Igors are no strangers to discomfort.
Jeremy looked down at the paperwork he'd been handed, and a name caught his eye. The top paper was signed. In a way, at least, there was a message in neat capitals, as neat as printing, and a name at the end. He will be useful. Le Jean. He remembered.
Oh, Lady Le Jean is behind this. She had you sent to me.
That's correct, sir.
Feeling that Igor was expecting more of him, Jeremy made a show of reading through the rest of what turned out to be references. Some of them were written in what he could only hope was dried brown ink. One was in crayon, and several were singed around the edges. They were all fulsome. After a while, though, a certain tendency could be noted among the signatories.
This one is signed by someone called Mad Dr. Scoop, he said.
Oh, he wasn't actually named Mad, sir. He was more like a nickname, as it were.
Was he mad, then?
Who can say, sir?
Said Igor calmly.
And crazed Baron Ha-Ha? It says under reason for leaving that he was crushed by a burning windmill.
Case of mistaken identity, sir.
Really?
Yes, sir. I understand the mob mistook him for screaming Dr. Berserk, sir.
Oh, yes. Jeremy glanced down. Who you also work for, I see.
Yes, sir.
And who died of blood poisoning?
Yes, sir. Caused by a dirty pitchfork.
And Nipsey the Impaler?
Would you believe he ran a kebab shop, sir?
Did he?
Not conventionally, though, sir.
You mean he was mad, too?
Well, he did have his little ways, I must admit. But an Eagle never passes judgment on his master or mistress, sir. That is the code of the Eagles, sir,
he added patiently.
It would be a funny old world if we were all alike, sir.
Jeremy was completely baffled as to his next move. He'd never been very good at talking to people, and this, apart from Lady Le Jean and a wrangle with Mr. Soak over an unwanted cheese, was the longest conversation he'd had for a year. Perhaps it was because it was hard to think of Igor as coming under the heading of people. Up until now, Jeremy's definition of people had not included anyone with more stitches than a handbag.
I'm not sure I've got any work for you, though, he said. I've got a new commission, but I'm not sure how... Anyway, I'm not insane.
That's not compulsory, sir.
I've actually got a piece of paper that says I'm not, you know.
Well done, sir.
Not many people have one of those.
Very true, sir.
I take medicine, you know.
Well done, sir, said Igor. I'll just go and make some breakfast, shall I, while you get dressed, master.
Jeremy clutched at his damp dressing gown.
I will be down shortly, he said, and hurried up the stairs.
Igor's gaze took in the racks of tools. There was not a speck of dust on them. The files, hammers, and pliers were ranged according to size, and the items on the workbench were positioned with geometrical exactitude. He pulled open a drawer. Screws were laid in perfect rows. He looked around at the walls. They were bare except for the shelves of clocks. This was surprising. Even dribbling Dr. Vibes had a calendar on the wall, which added a splash of color. Admittedly, it was from the Acid Bath and Restraint Company in Oogly, and the color it splashed was mostly red, but at least it showed some recognition of a world outside the four walls. Igor was puzzled. Igor had never worked for a sane person before. He'd worked for a number of, well, the world called them madmen, and he'd worked for several normal people, in that they only indulged in minor and socially acceptable insanities. But he couldn't recall ever working for a completely sane person. Obviously, he reasoned, if sticking screws up your nose was madness, then numbering them and keeping them in careful compartments was sanity, which was the opposite. No, it wasn't, was it? He smiled. He was beginning to feel quite at home already.
Lutzer, the sweeper, was in his garden of five surprises, carefully cultivating his mountain. His broom leaned against the hedge. Above him, looming over the temple gardens, the big stone statue of Wen, the eternally surprised, sat with its face locked in a permanent, wide-eyed expression of, yes, pleasant surprise. As a hobby, mountains appeal to those people who, in normal circumstances, are said to have a great deal of time on their hands. Lutzer had no time at all. Time was something that largely happened to other people. He viewed it in the same way that people on the shore viewed the sea. It was big, and it was out there, and sometimes it was an invigorating thing to dip a toe into, but you couldn't live in it all the time. Besides, it always made his skin wrinkle. At the moment, in the never-ending, ever-recreated moment of this peaceful, sunlit little valley, he was fiddling with the little mirrors and shovels and morphic resonators and even stranger devices required to make a mountain grow to no more than 6 inches high. The cherry trees were still in bloom. They always were in bloom here. A gong rang somewhere back in the temple. A flock of white doves took off from the monastery roof. A shadow fell over the mountain. Lutzer glanced at the person who had entered the garden. He made the perfunctory symbol of servitude to the rather annoyed-looking boy in the novice's robe. "Yes, master," he said. "I'm looking for the one they call Lutzer," said the boy. "Personally, I don't think he really exists." "I've got glaciation," said Lutzer, ignoring this, "at last. See, master? It's only an inch long, but already it's carving its own little valley. Magnificent, isn't it?" "Yes, yes, very good," said the novice, being kind to an underling. "Isn't this the garden of Lutzer?"
"You mean Lutzer, who is famous for his bonsai mountains?"
The novice looked from the line of plates to the little wrinkled, smiling man.
"You are Lutzer? But you're just a sweeper. I've seen you cleaning out the dormitories. I've seen people kick you."
Lutzer, apparently not hearing this, picked up a plate about a foot across, on which a small cinder cone was smoking.
"What do you think of this, master?" he said. "Volcanic. And it's bloody hard to do. Excuse my catching."
The novice took a step forward and leaned down and looked directly into the sweeper's eyes. Lutzer was not often disconcerted, but he was now.
"You are Lutzer?"
"Yes, lad. I am Lutzer."
The novice took a deep breath and thrust out a skinny arm. It was holding a small scroll.
From the abbot, venerable one."
The scroll wobbled in the nervous hand.
"Most people call me Lutzer, lad, or sweeper. Until they get to know me better, some call me Get Out of the Way," said Lutzer, carefully wrapping up his tools. "I've never been very venerable, except in cases of bad spelling."
He looked around the saucers for the miniature shovel he used for glacial work and couldn't see it anywhere. Surely he'd put it down just a moment ago. The acolyte was watching him with an expression of awe mixed with residual suspicion. A reputation like Lutzer's got around. This was the man who had, well, who had done practically everything, if you listen to all the rumours. But he didn't look as though he had. He was just a little, bald man with a wispy beard and a faint, amiable smile. Lutzer patted the young man on the shoulder in an effort to put him at his ease. "Let us see what the abbot wants," he said, unrolling the rice paper. "Oh, you are to take me to see him, it says here." A look of panic froze the novice's face. "What? How can I do that? Novices aren't allowed inside the inner temple." "Really? In that case, let me take you to take me to see him," said Lutzer. "You are allowed into the inner temple," said the novice, and then put his hand over his mouth. "But you're just a sweep." "That's right. Not even a proper monk, let alone a dong," said the sweeper cheerfully. "Amazing, isn't it? But people talk about you as if you were as high as the abbot." "Oh, dear me, no," said Lutzer. "I'm nothing like as holy. Never really got a grip on the cosmic harmony." But you've done all those incredible—" "Oh, I didn't say I'm not good at what I do," said Lutzer, as he ambled with his broom over his shoulder. "Just not holy. Oh, shall we go?"
Lutzer,
said the novice, following him along the ancient brick path.
"Yes?
Why is this called Garden of Five Surprises?" "What was your name back in the world, hasty young man?" said Lutzer.
Newgate.
Newgate Ludd, then." Lutzer held up a warning finger.
Sweeper, I mean."
"Ludd, eh? Hank Morpork Ludd?"
"Yes, sweeper,"
said the boy. The sudden dejected tone suggested he knew what was coming next. "Raised by the Thieves' Guild? One of Ludd's lads?" The boy, formerly known as Newgate, looked the old man in the eye, and when he replied, it was in the sing-song voice of someone who had answered the question too many times. "Yes, sweeper, yes, I was a foundling. Yes, we got called Ludd's lads and lasses after one of the founders of the guild. Yes, that's my adopted surname. Yes, it was a good life, and sometimes I wish I still had it." Lutzer appeared not to hear this. "Who sent you here?"
"A monk called Soto discovered me. He said I had talent."
"Marco? The one with all the hair?"
"Well, that's right. Only I thought the rule was that all monks were shaved."
"Oh, Soto says he is bald under the hair," said Lutzer. "He says the hair is a separate creature that just happens to live on him. They gave him a field posting really quickly after he came up with that one. Hard-working fellow, mark you, and friendly as anything, provided you don't touch his hair. Important lesson there. You don't survive in the field by obeying all the rules, including those related to mental processes."
"And what name were you given when you were enrolled?"
"Lobsang, then. Sweeper."
"Lobsang Ludd?"
"Yes, sweeper."
"Amazing. So, Lobsang Ludd, you tried to count my surprises, did you? Everybody does. Surprise is the nature of time, and five is the number of surprise."
"Well, yes, sweeper. I found the little bridge that tilts and throws you into the carp pool."
"Good, good.
And I found the bronze sculpture of a butterfly that flaps its wings when you breathe on it."
"That's two."
"There's the surprising way those little daisies spray you with venomous pollen."
"Ah, yes. Many people find them extremely surprising."
"And I believe the fourth surprise is the yodeling stick insect."
"Well done," said Lutzer, beaming. "It's very good, isn't it?"
"But I can't find the fifth surprise."
"Really? Let me know when you find it," said Lutzer. Lobsang Ludd thought about this as he trailed after the sweeper.
"The Garden of Five Surprises is a test," he said at last.
"Oh, yes. Nearly everything is." Lobsang nodded.
It was like the garden of the four elements. Every novice found the bronze symbols of three of them, in the carp pond, under a rock, painted on a kite, but none of Lobsang's classmates found fire. There didn't appear to be a fire anywhere in the garden.
After a while, Lobsang had reasoned thus. There were, in fact, five elements, as they had been taught. Four made up the universe, and the fifth, surprise, allowed it to keep on happening. No one had said that the four in the garden were the material four, so the fourth element in the garden could be surprised at the fact that fire wasn't there. Besides, fire was not generally found in a garden, and the other signs were truly in their element. So he'd gone down to the bakeries and opened one of the ovens, and there, glowing red hot below the loaves, was fire. And then, I expect that the fifth surprise is, there is no fifth surprise, he said.
Nice try, but no cylindrical smoking thing, said Ludza. And is it not written, oh, you are so sharp you'll cut yourself one of these days?
I haven't read that in the sacred text yet, Sweeper, said Lomsang, uncertainly.
No, you wouldn't have, said Ludza.
They stepped out of the brittle sunlight into the deep cold of the temple, and walked on through ancient halls and down stairways cut into the rock. The sound of distant chanting followed them. Ludza, who was not holy, and therefore could think unholy thoughts, occasionally wondered whether the chanting monks were chanting anything, or were just going, ah, ah, ah. You could never tell with all that echo. He turned off the main passage and reached for the handles of a pair of large red-lacquered doors. Then he looked behind him. Lobsang had stopped dead, some yards away.
Coming? But not even dongs are allowed in there, said Lobsang. You have to be a third Jim Ting at least.
Yeah, right. It's a short cut. Come on, it's drafty out here.
With extreme reluctance, expecting at any moment the outraged scream of authority, Lobsang trailed after the sweeper. And he was just a sweeper. One of the people who swept the floors and washed the clothes and cleaned the privies. No one had ever mentioned it. Novices heard about Ludza from their very first day, how he had gone into some of the most tangled knots of time and unravelled them, how he had constantly dodged the traffic on the crossroads of history, how he could divert time with a word and use this to develop the most subtle art of battle. And here was a little, skinny man who was sort of generically ethnic, so that he looked as though he could have come from anywhere. In a robe that had once been white before it fell to all those stains and patches, and the sandals repaired with string, and the friendly grin, as if he was constantly waiting for something amusing to happen. And no belt at all, just another piece of string to hold his robe closed. Even some novices got to the level of Grey Dong in their first year. The dojo was busy with senior monks at practice. Lobsang had to dodge aside as a pair of fighters whirled past, arms and legs blurring as each sought an opening, paring time into thinner and thinner slivers.
You, sweeper!
He looked around, but the shout had been directed at Ludza. A ting, only just elevated to the third gym by the fresh look of his belt, was advancing on the little man, his face red with fury.
What for are you coming in here, cleaner of filth? This is forbidden!
Luther's little smile didn't change, but he reached in his robe and brought out a small bag.
"'The shortcut,' he said.
He pulled a pinch of tobacco, and, while the ting loomed over him, began to roll a cigarette.
"'And there's dirt everywhere, too. I'll certainly have a word with a man who does this floor.'
"'How dare you insult!' screamed the monk. "'Back to the kitchens with you, sweeper!'
Cowering behind Ludza, Lobsang realized that the entire dojo had stopped to watch this. One or two of the monks were whispering to one another. The man in the brown robe of the dojo master was watching impassively from his chair, with his chin on his hand. With great patience and infuriating delicacy, like a samurai arranging flowers, Ludza marshaled the shreds of tobacco in the flimsy cigarette paper.
No, I reckon I'll go out of that door over there, if you don't mind. He said.
Impudence! Then you are ready to fight, enemy of dust!
The man leapt back and raised his hands to form the combat of the hake. He spun around and planted a kick on a heavy leather sack, hitting it so hard that its supporting chain broke. Then he was back to face Ludza, hands held in the advancement of the snake.
Ai, cho, hai, yi!
He began. The dojo master stood up.
Hold, he commanded. Do you not want to know the name of the man you are about to destroy? The fighter held his stance, glaring at Lutzer.
I don't need to know the name of a sweeper, he said.
Lutzer rolled the cigarette into a skinny cylinder and winked at the angry man, which only stoked the anger. It's always wise to know the name of a sweeper, boy, said the dojo master. And my question was not addressed to you.
End of side 2.